telescope observation. Knowing the transient noise might alert our hunter. The captain agreed. We gritted our teeth as the tube slid upward. Then, the image. Zombies, hundreds of them, were swarming over the howl. More arriving each second, stumbling across the barren sand, climbing over each other to claw, scrape, actually bite the gin steel.
Could they have gotten in? Open a hatch, or...
No. All hatches are sealed from the inside and torpedo tubes are protected by external bow caps. What concerned us, however, was the reactor. It was cooled by circulating seawater. The intakes, although not large enough for a man to fit through, can easily be blocked by one. Sure enough, one of our warning lights began to silently flash over the number 4 intake. One of them had ripped the guard off and was now thoroughly lodged in the conduit. The reactor's core temperature began to rise. To shut it down would leave us powerless. Captain Chen decided that we had to move. We lifted off the bottom, trying to be as slow and quiet as possible. It wasn't enough. We began to detect the sound of the 95's propeller. She had heard us and was moving in to attack. We heard her torpedo tubes being flooded and the click of her outer doors opening. Captain Chen ordered our own sonar to go active, pinging our exact location, but giving us a perfect firing solution on the 95. We fired at the same time. Our torpedoes passed each other as both subs tried to get away. The 95 was a little bit faster, a little more maneuverable. But the one thing they didn't have was our captain. He knew exactly how to avoid the oncoming fish, and we ducked them easily right about the time our own found their targets. We heard the 95's hull screech like a dying whale, bulkheads collapsing as compartments imploded one after the other. They tell you it happens too fast. For the crew to know, either the shock of the pressure change renders them unconscious, or the explosion can actually cause the air to ignite. The crew dies quickly, painlessly, at least that's what we hoped. One thing that wasn't painless was to watch the light behind my captain's eyes die with the sounds of the doomed sub.
He anticipates my next question, clenching his fist and exhaling hard through his nose.
Captain Chen raised his son alone, raised him to be a good sailor, to love and serve the state, to never question orders, and to be the finest officer the Chinese Navy had ever seen. The happiest day of his life was when Commander Chen Zixiao received his first command, a brand new Type 95 hunter killer.
The kind that attacked you.
That is why Captain Chen would have done anything to avoid our fleet. That was why it was so important to know which sub had attacked us. To know is always better, no matter what the answer might be. He had already betrayed his oath, betrayed his homeland. And now, to believe that that betrayal might have led him to murder his own son. The next morning, when Captain Chen did not appear for first watch, I went to his cabin to check on him. The lights were dim. I called his name. To my relief, he answered. But when he stepped into the light, his hair had lost its color, as white as pre-war snow. His skin was sallow, his eyes sunken. He was truly an old man now, broken, withered. The monsters that rose from the dead They are nothing compared to the ones we carry in our hearts. From that day on, we ceased all contact with the outside world. We headed for the Arctic ice, the farthest, darkest, most desolate void we could find. We tried to continue with our day-to-day life, maintaining the boat, growing food, schooling, racing, and comforting our children as best we could. With the captain's spirit gone, so went the spirit of the Admiral Jeune's crew. I was the only one who ever saw him during those days. I delivered his meals, collected his laundry, briefed him daily on the condition of the boat, then relayed his orders to the rest of the crew. It was routine, day in, day out. Our monotony was only broken one day when Sauna detected the approaching signature of another 95-class attack sub. We went to battle stations, and for the first time we saw Captain Chen leave his cabin. He took his place in the attack center, ordered a firing solution plotted, and tubes 1 and 2 loaded. Sauna reported that the enemy sub had not responded in kind. Captain Chen saw this as our advantage. There was no questioning in his mind this time. This enemy would die before it fired. Just before he gave the order, we detected a signal on the Gertrude, the American term for an underwater telephone. It was Commander Chen, the captain's son, proclaiming peaceful intentions and requesting that we stand down from GQ. He told us about the Three Gorges Dam, the source of all the natural disaster, rumors we had heard about in Manihi. He explained that our battle with the other 95 had been part of a civil war that the dam's destruction had sparked. The sub that attacked us had been part of the Loyalist forces. Commander Chen had sided with the rebels. His mission was to find us and escort us home. I thought the cheer was going to carry us right to the surface. As we broke through the ice and the two crews ran to each other under the Arctic twilight, I thought, finally, we can go home. We can reclaim our country and drive out the living dead. Finally, it's over.
But it wasn't.
There was still one last duty to perform. The Politburo, those hated old men who had caused so much misery already, were still holed up in their leadership bunker in Schillinghout, still controlling at least half of our country's dwindling ground forces. They would never surrender. Everyone knew this. They would keep their mad hold on power, squandering what was left of our military. If the civil war dragged on any longer, the only beings left in China would be the living dead.
And you decided to end the fighting?
We were the only ones who could. Our land-based silos were overrun. Our air force was grounded. Our two other missile boats had been caught still tied to the piers, waiting for orders like good sailors as the dead swam through their hatches. Commander Chen informed us that we were the only nuclear asset left in the rebellion's arsenal. Every second we delayed wasted 100 more lives, 100 more bullets that could be thrown against the undead.
So you fired on your homeland in order to save it.
One last burden to shoulder. The captain must have noticed me shaking the moment before we launched. My order, he declared, my responsibility. The missile carried a single, massive, multi-megaton warhead. It was a prototype warhead designed to penetrate the hardened surface of your NORAD facility in Cheyenne Mountain, Colorado. Ironically, the Politburo's bunker had been designed to emulate Cheyenne Mountain in almost every detail. As we prepared to get underway, Commander Chen informed us that Shirlin Hout had taken a direct hit. As we slid beneath the surface, we heard that the Loyalist forces had surrendered and reunified with the rebels to fight the real enemy.
Did you know they had begun instituting their own version of the South African plan?
We heard the day we emerged from under the ice pack. That morning, I came on watch and found Captain Chen already in the attack center. He was in his command chair, a cup of tea next to his hand. He looked so tired, silently watching the crew around him, smiling as the father smiles at the happiness of his children. I noticed his tea had grown cold and asked if he would like another cup. He looked up at me, still smiling, and shook his head slowly. "Very good, sir," I said, and prepared to resume my station. He reached out and took my hand, looked up into but did not recognize my face. His whisper was so soft, I could barely hear it.
"What?"
"Nice boy, Zhi Xiao. Such a good boy." He was still holding my hand when he closed his eyes. Forever.
Sydney, Australia. Clearwater Memorial is the newest hospital to be constructed in Australia and the largest one built since the end of the war. Terry Knox's room is on the 17th floor, the presidential suite. His luxurious surroundings and expensive, almost unobtainable medication are the least his government can do for the first and, to date, only Australian commander of the International Space Station. In his words, "Not bad for the son of an Andamooka opal miner." His withered body seems to liven during our conversation. His face regains some of its color.
"I wish some of the stories they tell about us were true. Makes us sound all the more heroic. Truth is, we weren't stranded. Not in terms of being suddenly or unexpectedly trapped up there. Nobody had a better view of what was happening than us. No one was surprised when the replacement crew from Baikonur failed to launch, or when Houston ordered us to pile into the X-38 for evacuation. I wish I could say that we violated orders or physically fought with one another over who should stay. What really happened was much more mundane and reasonable. I ordered the scientific team and any other non-essential personnel back to Earth, then gave the rest of the crew the choice to remain behind. With the X-38 re-entry lifeboat gone, we would be technically stranded, but when you think of what was at stake then, I can't imagine any of us wanting to leave. The ISS is one of the greatest marvels of human engineering. We're talking about an orbital platform so large it could be seen from Earth with the naked eye. It had taken 16 countries over 10 years, a couple hundred spacewalks, and more money than anyone without job security would admit to finally complete her. What would it take to build another one, if another one could ever be built? Even more important than the station was the incalculable and equally irreplaceable value of our planet's satellite network. Back then there were over 3,000 in orbit, and humanity depended on them for everything from communications to navigation, from surveillance to something even as mundane yet vital as regular and reliable weather prediction. This network was as important to the modern world as roads had been in ancient times, or rail lines during the Industrial Age. What would happen to humanity if these all-important links just started dropping out of the sky? Our plan was never to save them all. That was unrealistic and unnecessary. All we had to do was concentrate on the systems most vital to the war effort, Just a few dozen birds that had to remain aloft. That alone was worth the risk of staying.
Were you ever promised a rescue?
No. And we didn't expect it. The issue wasn't how we were going to get back to Earth. It was how we could manage to stay alive up there. Even with all our tanked O2 and emergency perchlorate candles, even with our water recycling system operating at peak capacity, we only had enough food for roughly 27 months, and that was including the test animals in the lab modules. None of them were being used to test any kind of vaccine, so their flesh was still edible. I can still hear their little shrieks, still see the spots of blood floating in microgravity. Even up there, you couldn't escape the blood. I tried to be scientific about it, calculating the nutritional value of every floating red globule I sucked out of the air. I kept insisting that it was all for the good of the mission and not my own ravenous hunger.
Tell me more about the mission. If you were trapped on the station, how did you manage to keep the satellites in orbit?
We used the Jules Verne 3 ATV, the last supply pod launched before French Guiana was overrun. It was originally designed as a one-way vehicle to be filled with trash after depositing its cargo, then sent back to Earth to burn up in the atmosphere. We modified it with manual flight controls and a pilot's couch. I wish we could have fixed it with a proper viewport. Navigating by video wasn't fun, neither was having to do my extravehicular activities, my spacewalks, in a re-entry suit because there wasn't room for a proper EVA kit. Most of my excursions were to the Astro, which was basically just a petrol station in space. Satellites, the military, surveillance type, sometimes have to change orbit in order to acquire new targets. They do that by firing their maneuvering thrusters and using up their small amount of hydrazine fuel. Before the war, the American military realized it was more cost-effective to have a refueling station already in orbit, rather than sending up a lot of manned missions. That's where Astro came in. We modified it to refuel some of the other satellites as well, the civilian models that need just the occasional top-off to boost back up from a decaying orbit. It was a marvelous machine, a real time-saver. We had a lot of technology like that. There was the Canadarm, the 50-foot robotic inchworm that performed necessary maintenance tasks along the station's outer skin. There was Boba, the VR-operated robonaut we fitted with a thruster pack so he could work both around the station and away from it on a satellite. We also had a little squadron of PSAs, these free-floating robots, about the shape and size of a grapefruit. All of this wondrous technology was designed to make our jobs easier. I wish they hadn't worked so well. We had maybe an hour a day, maybe even two, when there was nothing to do. You could sleep, you could exercise, you could reread the same books, you could listen to Radio Free Earth or to the music we'd brought with us over and over and over again. I don't know how many times I listened to that Red Gum song. God help me, I was only 19. It was my father's favourite. Reminded him of his time in Vietnam. I prayed that all that army training was helping to keep him and my mum alive now. I hadn't heard anything from him, or anyone else in Oz, since the government had relocated to Tasmania. I wanted to believe they were all right. But watching what was happening on Earth, as most of us did during our off-duty hours, made it almost impossible to have hope. They say that during the Cold War, American spy birds could read the copy of Pravda in a Soviet citizen's hands. I'm not sure if that's entirely true. I don't know the tech specs of that generation of hardware. But I can tell you that these modern ones whose signals we pirated from their relay birds, these could show muscles tear and bones snap. You could read the lips of victims crying out for mercy, or the color of their eyes when they bulge with their last breath. You could see at what point red blood began to turn brown, and how it looked on grey London cement as opposed to white Cape Cod sand. We had no control over what the spy birds chose to observe. Their targets were determined by the US military. We saw a lot of battles. Chongqing, Yonkers, We watched a company of Indian troops try to rescue civilians trapped in Ambedkar Stadium in Delhi, then become trapped themselves and retreat to Gandhi Park. I watched their commander form his men into a square, the kind the Limeys used in colonial days. It worked, at least for a little while. That was the only frustrating part about satellite surveillance. You could only watch, not listen. We didn't know that the Indians were running out of ammunition, only that the Z-heads were starting to close in. We saw a helo hover overhead and watched as the commander argued with his subordinates. We didn't know it was General Raj Singh. We didn't even know who he was. Don't listen to what the critics say about that man, about how he buggered off when things got too hot. We saw it all. He did try to put up a fight. And one of his blokes did smash him in the face with a rifle butt. He was out cold when they hauled him into that waiting chopper. It was a horrible feeling, seeing it all so close and yet unable to do anything. We had our own observation gear, both the civilian research birds and the equipment right there on the station. The images they gave us weren't half as powerful as the military versions, but they were still frighteningly clear. They gave us our first look at the mega swarms over Central Asia and the American Great Plains. Those were truly massive, miles across, like the American buffalo must have once been. We watched the evacuation of Japan and couldn't help but marvel at the scale. Hundreds of ships, thousands of small boats. We lost count of how many helicopters buzzed back and forth from the rooftops to the Armada, or how many jetliners made their final run north to Kamchatka. We were the first ones to discover zombie holes, the pits that the undead dig when they're going after burrowing animals. At first we thought they were just isolated incidents, until we noticed that they were spreading all over the world. Sometimes more than one would appear in close proximity to the next. There was a field in southern England. I guess there must have been a high concentration of rabbits. That was just riddled with holes, all different depths and sizes. Many of them had large, dark stains around them. Although we couldn't zoom in close enough, we were pretty sure it was blood. For me, that was the most terrifying example of our enemy's drive. They displayed no conscious thought, just sheer biological instinct. I once watched a Z-head go after something, probably a golden mole in the Namib Desert. The mole had burrowed deep into the slope of a dune. As the ghoul tried to go after it, the sand kept pouring down and filling the hole. The ghoul didn't stop, didn't react in any way. It just kept going. I watched it for 5 days, the fuzzy image of this G digging and digging and digging. Then suddenly one morning just stopping, getting up and shuffling away as if nothing had happened. It must have lost the scent. Good on the mole. For all our enhanced optics, nothing had quite the same impact as the naked eye. To just look through the viewport down on our fragile little biosphere, to see the massive ecological devastation makes one understand how the modern environmental movement began with the American space program. There were so many fires, and I don't just mean the buildings, or the forests, or even the oil rigs blazing out of control. Bleeding Saudis actually went ahead and did it. I mean the campfires as well. There had to be at least a billion of them, tiny orange specks covering the earth where electric lights had once been. Every day, every night, it seemed like the whole planet was burning. We couldn't even begin to calculate the ash count, but we guesstimated it was equivalent to a low-grade nuclear exchange between the United States and former Soviet Union. And that's not including the actual nuclear exchange between Iran and Pakistan. We watched and recorded those as well. The flashes and fires that gave me eye spots for days. Nuclear autumn was already beginning to set in, the grey-brown shroud thickening each day. It was like looking down on an alien planet, or on Earth during the last great mass extinction. Eventually, conventional optics became useless in the shroud, leaving us with only thermal or radar sensors. Earth's natural face vanished behind a caricature of primary colours. It was through one of these systems the Aster sensor aboard the Terra satellite, that we saw the Three Gorges Dam collapse. Roughly 10 trillion gallons of water, carrying debris, silt, rocks, trees, cars, houses, and house-sized pieces of the dam itself. It was alive. A brown and white dragon racing to the East China Sea. When I think of the people in its path, trapped in barricaded buildings, unable to escape the tidal wave because of the Z-heads right outside their doors. No one knows how many people died that night. Even today, they're still finding bodies.
One of his skeletal hands balls into a fist. The other presses the self-medicate button.
When I think about how the Chinese leadership tried to explain it all away, have you ever read a transcript of the Chinese president's speech? We actually watched the broadcast from a pirated signal off their Sinosat 2. He called it an unforeseen tragedy. Really? Unforeseen? Was it unforeseen that the dam had been built on an active fault line? Was it unforeseen that the increased weight of a giant reservoir had induced earthquakes in the past, and that cracks had already been detected in the foundation months before the dam was completed? He called it an unavoidable accident. Bastard. They had enough troops to wage open warfare in almost every major city, but they couldn't spare a couple of traffic cops to protect against a catastrophe waiting to happen. No one could imagine the repercussions of abandoning both the seismic warning stations and the emergency spillway controls. And then to try and change their story halfway through. To say that they'd actually done everything they could to protect the dam, that at the time of the disaster, valiant troops of the PLA had given their lives to defend it. Well, I'd been personally observing Three Gorges for over a year leading up to the disaster, and the only PLA soldiers I ever saw had given their lives a long, long time ago. Did they really expect their own people to buy such a blatant lie? Did they really expect anything less than all-out rebellion? 2 weeks after the start of the revolution, we received our first and only signal from the Chinese space station, Yang Liwei. It was the only other manned facility in orbit, but couldn't compare to such an exquisite masterpiece as ours. It was more of a slapdash job. Shenzhou modules and Long March fuel tanks cobbled together like a giant version of the old American Skylab. We'd been trying to contact them for months. We weren't even sure if there was a crew. All we got was a recorded message in perfect Hong Kong English to keep our distance lest we invite a response of deadly force. What an insane waste. We could have worked together, traded supplies, technical expertise. Who knows what we could have accomplished if we had only chucked the politics and come together as human bloody beings. We convinced ourselves that the station had never been inhabited at all, that their deadly force warning was just a ruse. We couldn't have been more surprised when the signal came over our ham radio. It was a live human voice, tired, frightened, and cutting out after only a few seconds. It was all I needed to board the Verne and head over to the Yang. As soon as it came over the horizon, I could tell that its orbit had shifted radically. As I closed the distance, I could see why. Their escape pod had blown its hatch, and because it was still docked to the primary airlock, the entire station had depressurized in seconds. As a precaution, I requested docking clearance. I got nothing. As I came aboard, I could see that even though the station was clearly large enough for a crew of 7 or 8, it only had the bunk space and personal kits for 2. I found the Yang packed with emergency supplies, enough food, water, and O2 candles for at least 5 years. What I couldn't figure out at first was why. There was no scientific equipment aboard, no intelligence gathering assets. It was almost like the Chinese government had sent these 2 men into space for no other purpose than to exist. 15 minutes into my floatabout, I found the first of several scuttling charges. This space station was little more than a giant orbital denial vehicle. If those charges were to detonate, the debris from a 400-metric-ton space station would not only be enough to damage or destroy any other orbiting platform, but any future space launch would be grounded for years. It was a scorched space policy. If we can't have it, neither can anyone else. All the station's systems were still operational. There had been no fire, no structural damage, no reason I could see to cause the accident of the escape pod's hatch. I found the body of a lone Tychonaut with his hand still clinging to the hatch release. He was wearing one of their pressurized escape suits, but the faceplate had been shattered by a bullet. I'm guessing the shooter was blown out into space. I'd like to believe that the Chinese Revolution wasn't just restricted to Earth, that the man who'd blown the hatch was also the one who had attempted to signal us. His mate must have stuck by the old guard. Maybe Mr. Loyalist had been ordered to set off the scuttling charges. Zhai. That was the name on his personal effects. Zhai had tried to blast his mate into space and had caught a round in the process. Makes for a good tale, I think. That's how I'm going to remember it.
Is that how you were able to extend your endurance? By using the supplies aboard the Yang? He gives me a thumbs up.
We cannibalized every inch of it for spares and materials. We would have liked to have merged the two platforms together, but we didn't have the tools or manpower for such an undertaking. We might have been able to use the escape pod to return to Earth. It had a heat shield and room for three. It was very tempting. But the station's orbit was decaying rapidly, and we had to make a choice then and there. Escape to Earth, or resupply the ISS. You know what choice we made. Before we finally abandoned her, we laid our friend Zhai to rest. We strapped his body into its bunk, brought his personal kit back to the ISS, and said a few words in his honor as the Yang burned up in the Earth's atmosphere. For all we knew, he might have been the Loyalist. Not the rebel. But either way, his actions allowed us to stay alive. 3 more years we remained in orbit. 3 more years that wouldn't have been possible without the Chinese consumables. I still think it's one of the war's great ironies that our replacement crew ended up arriving in a privately owned civilian vehicle. Spacecraft 3. The ship originally designed for pre-war orbital tourism. The pilot, with his cowboy hat and big confident Yankee grin. Anyone order take out?
He winces and self-medicates again.
Sometimes I'm asked if we regretted our decision to stay aboard. I can't speak for my mates. On their deathbeds they'd both said they'd do it all over again. How can I disagree? I don't regret the physical therapy that followed. Getting to know my bones again and remembering why the good Lord gave us legs in the first place. I don't regret being exposed to so much cosmic radiation. All those unprotected EVAs, all that time with inadequate shielding in the ISS. I don't regret this.
He motions to the hospital room and machinery attached to his body.
We made our choice. And I'd like to think we made a difference in the end. Not bad for the son of an Andamooka opal miner.
Terry Knox died 3 days after this interview. Ancud, Isla Grande de Chilo, Chile. While the official capital has returned to Santiago, this one-time refugee base now remains the economic and cultural center of the country. Ernesto Holguín calls the beach house on the island's Peninsula de la Cuy home, although his duties as a merchant ship's master keep him at sea for most of the year.
The history books call it the Honolulu Conference, but really it should have been called the Saratoga Conference, because that's all any of us had a chance to see. We spent 14 days in those cramped compartments and dank, stuffy passageways. USS Saratoga. From aircraft carrier to decommissioned hulk to evacuate transport barge to floating United Nations HQ. It also shouldn't have been called a conference. If anything, it was more like an ambush. We were supposed to be exchanging war-fighting tactics and technology. Everyone was anxious to see the British method of fortified motorways, which was almost as exciting as that live demonstration by Makunga Lalem. We were also supposed to be attempting to reintroduce some measure of international trade. That was my task specifically, to integrate the remnants of our navy into the new international convoy structure. I wasn't really sure what to expect from my time aboard Super Sara. I don't think anyone could have expected what actually happened. On the first day of the conference, we'd assembled for the introductions. I was hot and tired and wishing to God we could just get on without all the tiresome speeches. And then the American ambassador rose, and the whole world came to a screeching halt. "It was time to go on the attack," he said, "to all get out from behind our established defenses and begin retaking infested territory." At first, I thought he simply meant isolated operations, securing more inhabitable islands, or perhaps even reopening the Suez-Panama Canal zones. My supposition didn't last very long. He made it very clear that this was not going to be a series of minor tactical incursions. The United States intended to go permanently on the offensive, marching forward every day until, as he put it, every trace was sponged and purged, and if need be, blasted from the surface of the earth. Maybe he thought ripping off Churchill would give it some kind of emotional punch. It didn't. Instead, the room spontaneously combusted into argument. One side asked, "Why in hell should we risk even more lives? Suffer even one more unnecessary casualty when all we had to do was remain safe and sedentary while our enemy simply rotted away? Wasn't it happening already? Weren't the earliest cases starting to show signs of advanced decomposition? Time was on our side, not theirs. Why not let nature do all the work for us?" The other side countered that not all the living dead were rotting away. What about the later cases? The ones still strong and healthy and perfectly able to function. Couldn't just one restart the plague all over again? And what about those who prowled countries above the snow line? How long would we have to wait for them? Decades? Centuries? Would refugees from these countries ever have a chance of returning home? And that's when it got ugly. Many of the colder countries were what you used to call the First World. One of the delegates from a pre-war developing country suggested rather hotly that maybe this was their punishment for raping and pillaging the victim nations of the South. "Maybe," he said, "by keeping the white hegemony distracted with their own problems, the undead invasion might allow the rest of the world to develop without imperialist intervention. Maybe the living dead had brought more than just devastation to the world. Maybe in the end, they had brought justice for the future." Now, my people have little love for the northern gringos, and my family suffered enough under Pinochet to make their animosity personal. But there comes a point when private emotions must give way to objective facts. How could there be a white hegemony when the most dynamic pre-war economies were China and India, and the largest wartime economy was unquestionably Cuba? How could you call the colder countries a northern issue when so many people were just barely surviving in the Himalayas or the Andes of my own Chile? This man and those who agreed with him weren't talking about justice for the future. They just wanted revenge for the past. After all we'd been through, we still couldn't take our heads from out of our asses or our hands from round each other's throats. The room fell into anarchy, almost came to blows. I was standing next to the Russian delegate, trying to prevent her from climbing over her seat, when I heard another American voice. It was their president. The man didn't shout, didn't try to restore order. He just kept talking in that calm, firm tone that I don't think any world leader has since been able to duplicate. He even thanked his fellow delegates for their valued opinions and admitted that, from a purely military perspective, there was no reason to push our luck. We'd fought the living dead to a stalemate, and eventually future generations might be able to re-inhabit the planet with little or no physical danger. Yes, our defensive strategies had saved the human race, but what about the human spirit? The living dead had taken more from us than land and loved ones. They'd robbed us of our confidence as the planet's dominant life form. We were a shaken, broken species, driven to the edge of extinction and grateful only for a tomorrow with perhaps a little less suffering than today. Was this the legacy we would leave to our children? A level of anxiety and self-doubt not seen since our simian ancestors cowered in the tallest trees? What kind of world would they rebuild? Would they rebuild at all? Could they continue to progress knowing that they had been powerless to reclaim their future? And what if that future saw another rise of the living dead? Would our descendants rise to meet them in battle, or simply crumple in meek surrender and accept what they believe to be their inevitable extinction? For this reason alone, we had to reclaim our planet. We had to prove to ourselves that we could do it, and leave that proof as this war's greatest monument. The long, hard road back to humanity, or the regressive ennui of Earth's once proud primates? That was the choice, and it had to be made now. So typically Norte Americano, reaching for the stars with her asses still stuck in the mud. I guess if this was a gringo movie, you'd see some idiot get up and start clapping slowly. Then the others would join in, and then we'd see a tear roll down someone's cheek or some other contrived bullshit like that. Everyone was silent. No one moved. The president announced that we could recess for the afternoon to consider his proposal, then reconvene at dusk for a general vote. As naval attaché, I wasn't allowed to participate in that vote. While the ambassador decided the fate of our beloved Chile, I had nothing to do but enjoy the Pacific sunset. I sat on the flight deck, wedged in between the windmills and solar cells, killing time with my opposite numbers from France and South Africa. We tried not to talk shop, searching for any common subject as far from the war as we could get.
You were pretty confident about the vote.
Not that it would be unanimous, and I was damn right. 17 no votes and 31 abstain. At least the no voters were willing to suffer the long-term consequences of their decision, and they did. When you think that the new UN only consisted of 72 delegates, the showing of support was pretty poor. But for us, our countries, our children, the choice had been made. Attack.
Part 7. Total War.
Aboard the Mauro Altieri, 3,000 feet above Valjärvi, Finland. I stand next to General D'Ambrosia in the CIC, the Combat Information Center, of Europe's answer to the massive U.S. D-29 command and control dirigible. The crew work silently at their glowing monitors. Occasionally one of them speaks into a headset, a quick, whispered acknowledgement in French, German, Spanish, or Italian. The general leans over the video chart table, watching the entire operation from the closest thing to a god's eye view.
Attack. When I first heard that word, my gut reaction was, oh shit. Does that surprise you?
Before I can answer.
Sure it does. You probably expected the brass to be just champing at the bit, all that blood and guts, hold him by the nose while we kick him in the ass crap. I don't know who created the stereotype of the hard-charging, dim-witted high school football coach of a general officer. I was scared to death of taking our armed forces on the offensive. More so because it wouldn't be my ass hanging out in the fire. I'd only be sending others out to die. and here's what I'd be sending them up against.
He turns to another screen on the far wall, nodding to an operator, and the image dissolves into a wartime map of the continental United States.
200 million zombies. Who can even visualize that type of number, let alone combat it? At least this time around, we knew what we were combating, but when you added up all the experience, all the data we compiled on their origin, their physiology, their strengths, their weaknesses, their motives, and their mentality, it still presented us with a very gloomy prospect for victory. The Book of War, the one we've been writing since one ape slapped another, was completely useless in this situation. We had to write a new one from scratch. All armies, be they mechanized or mountain guerrilla, have to abide by three basic restrictions. They have to be bred, fed, and led. Bred, you need warm bodies, or else you don't have an army. Fed, once you've got that army, they've got to be supplied. And led, no matter how fractured or decentralized that fighting force is, there has to be someone among them with the authority to say, follow me. Bred, fed, and led. And none of these restrictions applied to the living dead. Did you ever read All Quiet on the Western Front? Remarque paints a vivid picture of Germany becoming empty, meaning that toward the end of the war they were simply running out of soldiers. You can fudge the numbers, send the old men and little boys, but eventually you're going to hit the ceiling. Unless every time you killed an enemy, he came back to life on your side. That's how Zack operated, swelling his ranks by thinning ours. And it only worked one way. Infect a human, he becomes a zombie. Kill a zombie, he becomes a corpse. We could only get weaker, while they might actually get stronger. All human armies need supplies. This army didn't. No food, no ammo, no fuel, not even water to drink or air to breathe. There were no logistic lines to sever, no depots to destroy. You couldn't just surround and starve them out, or let them wither on the vine. Lock 100 of them in a room, and 3 years later they'll come out just as deadly. It's ironic that the only way to kill a zombie is to destroy its brain, because as a group, they have no collective brain to speak of. There was no leadership, no chain of command, no communication or cooperation on any level. There was no president to assassinate, no HQ bunker to surgically strike. Each zombie is its own self-contained automated unit. And this last advantage is what truly encapsulates the entire conflict. You've heard the expression total war? It's pretty common throughout human history. Every generation or so, some gas bag likes to spout about how his people have declared total war against an enemy, meaning that every man, woman, and child within his nation were committing every second of their lives to victory. That is bullshit on two basic levels. First of all, no country or group is ever 100% committed to war. It's just not physically possible. You can have a high percentage, so many people working so hard for so long, but all of the people? All of the time? What about the malingerers or the conscientious objectors? What about the sick, the injured, the very old, the very young? What about when you're sleeping, eating, taking a shower, taking a dump? Is that a dump for victory? That's the first reason total war is impossible for humans. The second is that all nations have their limits. There might be individuals within that group who are willing to sacrifice their lives. It might even be a relatively high number for the population, but that population as a whole will eventually reach its maximum emotional and physiological breaking point. The Japanese reached theirs with a couple of American atomic bombs. The Vietnamese might have reached theirs if we dropped a couple more, but thank holy Christ, our will broke before it came to that. That is the nature of human warfare. Two sides, trying to push the other past its limit of endurance. And no matter how much we like to talk about total war, that limit is always there. Unless you're the living dead. For the first time in history, we faced an enemy that was actively waging total war. They had no limits of endurance. They would never negotiate, never surrender. They would fight until the very end because, unlike us, every single one of them, every second of every day, was devoted to consuming all life on Earth. That's the kind of enemy that was waiting for us beyond the Rockies. That's the kind of war we had to fight.
Denver, Colorado, USA. We have just finished dinner at the Wainios. Allison, Todd's wife, is upstairs helping their son Addison with his homework. Todd and I are downstairs in the kitchen, doing the dishes.
It was kind of like stepping back in time. The new army, I mean. It couldn't have been any more different from the one I'd fought and almost died with at Yonkers. We weren't mechanized anymore. No tanks, no arty, no tread jobs at all, not even the Bradleys. Those were still in reserve, being modified for when we'd have to take back the cities. No, the only wheeled vehicles we had, the Humvees and a few ASVs, were used to carry ammo and stuff. We hoofed it all the way, marching in column like you see in Civil War paintings. There was a lot of references to the blue versus the gray, mainly because of Zach's skin color and the shade of our new BDUs. They didn't bother with camo schemes anymore. In any case, what was the point? And, I guess, navy blue was the cheapest dye they had back then. The BDU itself looked more like a SWAT team's coverall. It was light and comfortable and interwoven with Kevlar. I think it was Kevlar. Bite-proof threads. It had the option of gloves and a hood that would cover your whole face. Later, in urban hand-to-hand, that option saved a lot of lives. Everything had a kind of retro feel about it. Our Lobos looked like something out of, I don't know, Lord of the Rings. Standard orders were to use it only when necessary, but trust me, we made it necessary a lot. It just felt good, you know, swinging that solid hunk of steel. It made it personal, empowering. You could feel the skull split, a real rush, like you were taking back your life, you know? Not that I minded pulling the trigger. Our primary weapon was the SIR, standard infantry rifle. The wood furniture made it look like a World War II gun. I guess composite materials were too hard to mass-produce. No matter what you did to this baby, it just wouldn't let you down. Only bells and whistles it had was a conversion kit of extra parts, furniture, and additional barrels of different lengths. You could go long-range sniper, mid-range rifle, or close combat carbine all in the same hour and without reaching farther than your ruck. It also had a spike, this little flip-out job about 8 inches long that you could use in a pinch if your Lobo wasn't handy. We used to joke, careful, you'll poke somebody's eye out, which, of course, we did plenty. The SIR made a pretty good close combat weapon, even without the spike, and when you add all the other things that made it so awesome, you could see why we always referred to it respectfully as SIR. Our staple ammo was the NATO 5.56 Cherry Pie. Pie stands for Pyrotechnically Initiated Explosive. Outstanding design. It would shatter on entry into Zach's skull, and fragments would fry its brain. No risk of spreading infected gray matter, and no need for wasteful bonfires. On BS duty, you didn't even have to decap before you buried them. Just dig the trench and roll the whole body in. Yeah, it was a new army, as much the people as anything else. Recruitment had changed, and being a grunt meant something very different now. You still had the old requirements, physical stamina, mental competence, the motivation and discipline to master difficult challenges in extreme conditions. But all that was hamster farts if you couldn't hack long-term Z-Shock. I saw a lot of good friends just lose it under the strain. Some of them collapsed, some turned their weapons on themselves, some on their buddies. It didn't have anything to do with being brave or anything like that. I once read this British SAS survival guide that talked about all the warrior personality, how your family's supposed to be emotionally and financially stable, and how you're not even supposed to be attracted to girls when you're real young. Survival guides.
Todd jerks his hand in a masturbatory movement.
But the new faces, they could have been from anywhere. Your neighbor, your aunt, that geeky substitute teacher, or that fat, lazy slob at the DMV. From former insurance salesman to a guy I'm damn sure was Michael's type, although I never got him to admit it. I guess it all made sense. Anyone who couldn't roll wouldn't have made it this far in the first place. Everyone was already a veteran in some sense. My battle buddy, Sister Montoya, 52 years old, she'd been a nun, still was, I guess. 5'3" and a buck even, she'd protected her whole Sunday school class for 9 days with nothing but a 6-foot iron candlestick. I don't know how she managed to hump that ruck, but she did, without complaining, from our assembly area in Needles all the way to our contact site just outside of Hope, New Mexico. We'd encountered a couple of G's en route. Sniffer dogs would find them, and handlers with silenced weapons would drop them. We didn't want to attract too many till we were set. We wanted this to be on our terms. We started planting our garden. Shelter stakes with orange day-glow tape in rows every 10 meters. They were our range markers, showing us exactly where to zero our sights. For some of us, there was also some light duty like clearing the brush or arranging the ammo crates. Around 1300 hours, the radios started squawking. It was the K-handlers whose dogs had made contact. We locked and loaded and took our place on the firing line. That was the centerpiece of our whole new battle doctrine, back into the past like everything else. We massed in a straight line, two ranks, one active, one reserve. The reserve was so when anyone in the front rank needed a weapon recharge, their fire wouldn't be missed on the line. Theoretically, with everyone either firing or reloading, we could keep Zack falling as long as the ammo held out. We could hear the barking. The K's were bringing them in. We started seeing G's on the horizon, hundreds. I started shaking, even though it wasn't the first time I had to face Zack since Yonkers. I'd been in the clean and sweep operations in L.A. I'd done my time in the Rockies when the summer thawed the passes. Each time I got the major shakes. The dogs were recalled, racing behind our lines. We switched over to our primary enticement mechanism. Every army had one by now. The Brits would use bagpipes. The Chinese used bugles. The South Africans used to smack their rifles with their assegais and belt out those Zulu war chants. For us, it was hardcore Iron Maiden. Now, personally, I've never been a metal fan. Straight classic rock's my thing, and Hendrix's Driving South is about as heavy as I get. But I had to admit, standing there in that desert wind with the Trooper thumping in my chest, I got it. The PEM wasn't really for Zack's benefit. It was to psych us up, take away some of Zack's mojo, you know, take the piss out, as the Brits say. Right about the time Dickinson was belting, "As You Plunge Into a Certain Death," I was pumped, surcharged and ready, eyes fixed on this growing, closing horde. I was like, come on, Zack, let's fucking do this. Just before they reached the front range marker, the music began to fade. The squad leader shouted, "Front rank ready," and the first line knelt. Then came the order to take aim, and then, as we all held our breath, as the music clicked off, we heard, "Fire!" The front rank just rippled, cracking like a saw on full auto, and dropping every G that crossed the first markers. We had strict orders. Only the ones crossing the line. Wait for the others. We trained this way for months. By now, it was pure instinct. Sister Montoya raised her weapon above her head, the signal for an empty mag. We switched positions. I flipped off my safety and sighted my first target. She was a noob, couldn't have been dead for more than a year or so. Her dirty blonde hair hung in patches from her tight, leathery skin. Her swollen belly puffed through a faded black T-shirt that read, "G is for Gangsta." I centered my sight right between her shrunken, milky blue eyes. You know, it's not really the eyes that make them look all cloudy. It's actually tiny dust scratches on the surface, thousands of them, because Zack doesn't make any tears. Those scratched-up baby blues were looking right at me when I pulled the trigger. The round knocked her on her back, steam coming from the hole in her forehead. I took a breath, sighted my next target, and that was that. I was locked in. Doctrine calls for one shot every full second. Slow, steady, mechanical-like.
He begins snapping his fingers.
On the range, we practice with metronomes. All the time, instructors saying, "They ain't in no hurry, wire you." It was a way of keeping calm, pacing yourself. We had to be as slow and robotic as them. "Out G the G," they used to say.
His fingers snap in perfect rhythm.
Shooting, switching, reloading, grabbing sips from your camel pack, grabbing clips from the Sandlers.
Sandlers?
Yeah, the recharge teams. Sandlers were lifesavers, drilled like a fucking ballet. I don't think anyone that day or night ever found themselves one round short.
That night?
They just kept coming. Full-on chain swarm.
That's a large-scale attack.
More than that. One G sees you, comes after you, and moans. A click away, another G hears that moan, comes after it, and moans himself. Then another one, another click away, then another. Dude, if the area's thick enough, if the chain's unbroken, Who knows how far you can pull them in from? And we're talking one after the other here. Try 10 every click, 100, 1,000. They started piling up, forming this artificial palisade at the first range marker, this ridge of corpses that got higher and higher each